Welcome everyone to the Majewski Lecture. I'm very pleased and honoured to welcome one of the foremost anthropologists working in South Asian studies today, in my view, Dr. Rich Freeman from Duke University. He's done work on, for many, many years now, on the traditions of Kerala. He's fluent in Malayalam, and he's one of those anthropologists who also knows Sanskrit, so he understands the importance of text in work on contemporary ethnography, if you like, and also the importance of field work for understanding textual tradition as well. He's done work on the Teyam tradition of Kerala, the dance possession rites of Kerala, for many years. And he's also done very important, groundbreaking work, in my view, on the Malayalam literature, the history of Malayalam literature, and the history of the tantric traditions of Kerala that he's going to speak about today. That door's locked. So, my great honour to welcome Rich today, who's going to speak to us, share his work with us on the tantric traditions of Kerala. There's also another important thing I'd like to point out is his work on the dance possession rituals of Kerala as a model for ritual possession as a model for understanding religion in South Asia generally, which he's put forward as a very important thesis, I think, which I hope he will one day thematize and bring out more in his publications. So, without further ado, I'll hand over to Rich, who's going to speak to us on the tantric traditions of Kerala.
Okay, well, thank you, Gavin, for that generous introduction. And thank you all for coming here on this lovely day and putting up with the move of the room and the various technological problems here. I apologize that this really didn't have much of a title going into it. I'm working with today is I've been something of a vagrant all year, so I'm moving around a lot. And most of my library and the resources I'm used to drawing on are back in the States, where they've been under lock and key for a year. I will tentatively retitle this talk something like Towards an Historical Ethnology of Tantra in Kerala. What I want to do is not really give any kind of general lecture on tantric texts or practices in Kerala per se, but instead use a case study of a particular low-caste deity and look at it in terms of its implications for the study of tantra in Kerala and in the wider region. So I'm basically just going to go in-depth into a sort of case study of this deity I've been fascinated with for a number of years now. I've spent a number of years working on the Sanskritic textual side of tantra in Kerala, which is basically just what we would call agamic religion anywhere else in South India, but they still call it tantra in Kerala. And I'm convinced that what we need is more attention paid to the vernacular sources, the folklore, the inscriptional record, the historical record, and the way these all fit together. So this is an attempt to try to work through a little of that today, just as I said, with one particular case study. In general, just to start with something general, which I just said I wouldn't do, just to characterize Hindu tantrism as it relates to me centrally in this work, while we tend to associate tantrism with the more notorious aspects coming in some sense out of Victorian Indology and so on, with ritualized sex, the consumption of liquor, meat, blood sacrifice, spirit possession, and so on, there are some larger sort of implications for tantra that are fascinating and really, in some sense, underlie what we think of as contemporary paradigms of puja and worship in general. It is tantric. It's not generally recognized as such, partly because of the kind of assimilation, the very clever assimilation that's gone on through time. The real import in certain theological aspects of Hindu tantrism is that it relies on extra-Vedic revelation. Agamas or tantras, which are the word of the deity, that are a kind of higher revelation than the Vedas, not necessarily supplanting the Vedas, but having those claims. Then, of course, the various kind of heterodox rites that lie outside of Brahminical control, the kind of notorious aspects and simply non-Brahminical ones, the confrontation with Brahmins that this then entailed, and then the subsequent assimilation by Brahmins and by Brahminical structures of these back into mainstream Hinduism. So there's this long kind of complex dialogue through time that goes on in this way that's fascinating to think about. I'm not going to go into any of this really today, except just to use it as the background and the context for tracing out then my ethnographic concern with a particular tantric deity in Kerala. The specific place for my research, this is the northern coast of Kerala, basically Calicut and Kannur districts up to Mangalore, which is the southernmost major city settlement in southern Karnataka in the Tulu country, just abutting on these northern Kerala districts. And within this region, I have dealt, as Gavin said, for many years with the folk tantric. So what I want to do is look at the folk tantric side of things, the lower caste side of things, and the upper caste Brahminical notions of tantra, and see how they articulate through the particular vagaries of this particular deity. So Kerala folk tantrism in these northern districts is characterized by a low caste cult called Theyattam, which literally means the dance of the theams, of the deities. It's practiced by all of those castes, possibly the majority of castes in northern Kerala, who were excluded from temples. So the Brahminically controlled, tantrically administered temples excluded a large chunk of the society. And they set up then these parallel shrines dedicated to their own theam deities, these local deities. They worship them historically, and they still do very vigorously through spirit-possessed dancing. And these are substantively tantric rites in many ways that we could talk about. Theam shrines usually sit, except for evening lamp lighting, sit unused throughout the year until it's time for a theam festival, at which point they're opened up. Elaborately costumed dancers who have hereditary entitlements. These are, as I said, members of these lower castes who were formerly excluded from temples and their constituencies, their worshiping constituencies, invoke the power of the deity into themselves, these professional dancers, these professional entitled dancers, through liturgies, through recitation of the theam liturgies of these local gods, and then become those local gods. And this is one of these Bhagavati deities here. And what's in the shrine is simply her sword or some other insignia, and there's been a kind of invocation out of that insignia and into her, him playing her. They then cavort around, interact with the worshippers, receive offerings from them, give physical grace in return, have all kinds of verbal interactions, and speak as these particular gods with the worshipping constituencies. Many of them are folk heroes, the apotheoses of local people who were killed or who died in battle, who were sometimes the victim of high caste oppression. And there are hundreds of these deities, each with their own stories, each with their own liturgies, each incarnating then these particular gods as their sort of chosen profession in life, still taken very seriously and very vigorously. I just went back a couple months ago after some 15 years absence from this region, and I was quite amazed at the vibrancy with which it's still going on. You can see in the background, you can't actually, but a fellow's holding a cock there, which is ready to be sacrificed. And indeed, part of the tantric interpretation of this, here they've decapitated a chicken, and they're dousing its severed neck into this large body of artificial blood called kudadi, which is then charged up with the real blood. The altars that you see there are actually toddy pot altars. The pots are not on there now, but so this association of blood sacrifice, liquor, possession, and so on is classically, in some sense, tantric, we would say. At the other end of high Kerala tantrism, we have high caste Nambudri Brahmins. The Nambudris are the dominant Brahminical caste in Kerala and really the only significant Brahminical caste, indigenous Brahminical caste. They are the exclusive officiants of temples, and they hold what they call a tantri status or office over those temples, meaning that they regulate and determine the rituals within the temples, and they have their own shastras that they follow and so on that are historically related, of course, to the wider tantric and agamic traditions in South India. And unlike elsewhere in India, for the most part, they are not at all embarrassed about the label tantric and tantrika, and they call themselves tantris very proudly and very exclusively. This is taken in a temple festival at a school for training priests that I worked at for many years. This is an active, living temple. And this young man is channeling his prana, his life's energies, through a darbha grass into these pots that are then going to be charged up and used for bathing the deity. Is someone trying to get in the back door there? Yeah. Is it possible just to crack it open so that... okay. Anyway, so this is then the high end, right? So if you've got the thayams at one end, you have this at the other. And the two ends meet and articulate in very interesting ways. Part of that articulation comes through the Brahmins themselves. And this is a rite by these same lofty Nambudris who are exclusively working in the temples. I'm sorry, the light is coming in and interfering with this, but what he's doing is this Nambudri priest is offering copious handfuls of artificial blood, the same blood you saw in the earlier compound without real chickens involved, offering these huge cauldrons of artificial blood and pouring them and veiling it with his hands over this what's called a mandalam, which is clearly a kind of rustic altar made out of palm fronds. The word gudasi itself is a Sanskritization of the old Dravidian, the old Tamil word kudadi, which means the blood that's offered in sacrifice. So it's actually human blood, conceptually, at some level. So there is then this complex kind of articulation, and also then the kind of folkloric component to Brahminical practice. With that as background, I want to turn to a specific site that I worked at and I'm interested in, Karlagat, which is the site of a Brahminical manor where the deity that I'm going to speak about came into being. And it's, you can see between Kannur and Nileshwaram to the north on the inland on the Kerala coast, and it's really in the kind of rustic mountain areas. The god I want to speak about is the god Bhairavan, and Bhairavan is incarnated as a Theyam deity as he appears here. And what I want to do then is just tell the myths, dedicate this talk to the myths of this one particular deity and the various trajectories that myth takes. And I want to base myself then on the liturgical myths that are told, as I said, as the device really to bring on his possession. And so there's a number of these myths that are laminated together within this corpus of liturgies that are recited to turn an ordinary former untouchable into the high god Bhairavan, as you see here. Unlike a lot of Theyam deities, and I showed you the folk deities earlier who were incarnations of warrior deities, warrior gods, and so on, Bhairavan has, of course, as you know from the name and the exposure, a kind of pan-Indic pedigree and a set of pan-Indic myths. Part of the Theyam myth traces this and indeed gives a kind of a fairly standard account of the Puranic myths that we're accustomed to. And a performer then gave this to me as the basis as derived from his particular liturgy. This is the famous myth about when the gods Shiva and Brahma are arguing as to which of them is greater. And Brahma insults Shiva by disparaging his, basically what we would recognize as his tantric practices. That is that you cavort in cremation grounds with ghouls, you're drunk all the time, you smear yourself with ashes of the dead, you eat anything you want, and so on and so forth. In his rage, Shiva produces then an incarnation called Bhairavan, means the horrific one, the horrible one, who immediately decapitates Brahma, cuts off his fifth head, Brahma now only has four heads. He used to have five until Vaidevan cut off the fifth one. Brahma is immediately realizes that this is not the right course of action, falls at his feet and craves his forgiveness, and he's forgiven and released, albeit without his head. But for the crime of Brahminicide, where the god Brahma is assimilated to the caste of Brahmins, Vaidevan is cursed to have the head that he decapitated stuck to his hand. So he has to wander then, wander the world carrying the severed head, which of course rots and ends up as the skull, through which he then has to beg for alms and eventually hope for his release. In fact, as David Lawrenson and others have long pointed out, this penance, this kapalaka, kapala is the skull bowl, this penance is the actual penance for Brahminicide that was given in the Dharmashastric texts. So when you killed a Brahmin, you were supposed to go through this. So it seems then very interestingly that there is among these Bhairava yogis, who are historically attested, that they were in fact acting out in life Brahminicide, which they presumably had not actually committed. But they were in some sense in the role as though we are Brahmin killers. And of course, many of them were Brahmins themselves, which creates a very peculiar set of tensions, right? Historically, we have the attestation of Bhairava yogis, that is, of yogis who wandered around in this penitent costume, carrying skull bowls and collecting alms in this way. The Kapalakas were itinerant monks who wandered and who were not very well known from inscriptions and such things because they weren't institutionally based in general. What we do have is a lot of caricatures of them from literature beginning probably as early as the 7th century, various dramas that usually caricaturing them in a negative light, making fun of them and deriding them in various ways for their low practices. But what happens then in South India, in Karnataka, just to the north of the area where I worked, is that from about the 11th to the 13th centuries, you have a group of institutionalized, apparently Kapalaka monks called the Kalamukas, literally the black-faced ones. And again, David Lawrenson's classic monograph on these groups has charted their history, mostly in Karnataka and mostly through these inscriptions. Anyway, with this quick glimpse then of Vaidava as this Indic wanderer, I want to go back then to his Kerala myth and to look at another portion of the Deum liturgy that then localizes this kind of broad overview, although the two will come together, as you'll see. The local version of Vaidava in the first part of the Deum liturgy tells that Vaidava was a student of tantra and of sorcery, under one Kanaka Raja, literally the Golden King, at Kangala or Skeleton Mountain, and that he was dissatisfied with his studies there, studying tantra and sorcery and so on, and decided that he would descend to earth on a thread and appeared in the banyan tree of an individual known as the Kadara Raja, the king of Kadaram. The king, being very surprised to find this scary character dropping down, begins to offer him hospitality immediately, and he refuses that and says that he's not really interested in being treated in an honored guest in this way, but what he demands instead is an elaborate sacrificial homam, a fire sacrifice to be performed in worship of him. And he warns that if anything goes wrong with this elaborate homam of 1,000 sticks of jackwood and perfect mantras and so on and so forth, that there's going to be a terrible kind of restitution demanded. The nervous Kadaram king begins to try to perform this, and of course everything goes wrong. The restitution turns out to be that this Bhairavan turns and grabs his maternal nephew, which in the matrilineal system is his heir, and throws the child alive into the fire and burns him up. I'll come back then to this, and that's the first sort of happy little episode of this Deum liturgy. And I'll come back to the identity of this this Raja a little bit later. The second part of the liturgy then tells that Bhairava continued apparently southward, and it's not sure where he was in the earlier episode yet, but he continues to head south into northern Kerala and to establish his presence in 18 illams, or these lineage manors of the Brahmins, and shows up at the manor of Kalagat Illam, which is the one I showed you, the inland area in from the coast in northern Kerala. It's well known for its, Kalagat Illam is well known, the Tantri there, that is the Brahmin chieftain of that place, is well known for his control of demons, of sorcery, and of generally of trafficking in fairly unsavory gods, but he's a very powerful individual and actually serves as the Tantri over a number of temples in northern Kerala. So as one of these then foremost individuals, he's submitted to the same tests as the earlier Kadaram Raja. That is, Bhairavan says, you know, you've got to do these various elaborate homilies for me, or there's going to be some horrible vengeance exacted. The difference in this case, though, is that the Brahmin quickly offers to propitiate Bhairava. He tries to do the homam, the performance and all that, and he flubs it up, he messes it up. And then Bhairava is about to grab his child and throw him in the fire, and he says, wait a minute, I've got another idea. We'll institute the worship of you here. And so the Kalagat Illam then indeed turns to the worship of this archetypically tantric god, Bhairavan, and offers him pujas in the main household sanctum according to Brahminical worship, and then institutes a theyam for him out in the outer compound for access and control of the lower caste groups who would assemble there. In another episode, which puts a more positive spin on this, Bhairavan's, the Kalagat Tantri is once wandering in a market called Irikur, which is a merchant community in the highlands of Kerala. And the merchants there mock him and say, look, there goes a Kala. The Kalagat means buffalo forest. And so they're calling the Brahmin a buffalo. And he's very upset by this. And he says, well, if my mantra murtis, that is my deities back in the Illam, back in my manor, that consist of Bhairavan and Kutichathan and various other gods, if they indeed have power, then they won't let this offense go unpunished. And sure enough, then the family gods, now headed by Bhairavan, come to avenge this insult to his dignity. The settlement of Irikur is burned from one end to the other. Those that mocked him were driven mad with delirium and possessing spirits. And so it shows then how there's a positive gain to be made in some sense through trafficking in these kinds of dams. The other story, the other aspect of this that becomes interesting then, and in the interest of time I may have to skip this particular deity, interesting though he is, is that Bhairavan, one of these mantra murtis, is twinned with a god named Kutichathan, who's a purely local sort of reflex of many of these same themes, only, if anything, much more horrific. He's an adoptive son who ends up, here's what he looks like, also installed at Kalagat Illam. He's an adoptive son who ends up, he's a forest foundling who ends up then rebelling against the Brahmin, assaulting his wife, killing his guru, doing various awful things, eating his cattle alive, and so on, and he's eventually decapitated. But it turns out that he can't be controlled in this way. Once he's decapitated, his spirit shows up in the Brahmin Illam, and the Brahmin has to propitiate him, and so they hold a whole series of homams, and wherever they set up a homam, Kutichathan's spirit emerges, Brahmin settlements are burned. It says at one point that even 41 heads are taken. We're not sure whose heads. As a result of that, then, this deum comes to be worshipped again by these Brahmins and incorporated into the pantheon as a kind of twinned aspect of Bhairavan to some extent. You can even see this physically. This is the Bhairavan I showed you earlier. This is another form of Kutichathan. I showed you the more elaborate form a couple slides earlier. But you can see that except for the crowns, the costume is identical. And what happens is actually Kutichathan turns into Bhairavan. So there's this twinning of these gods, which is quite quite interesting. At any rate, if what I want to do now is pick up another stream of this same set of liturgies, and I'll promised to bring these together a little bit. I'm leaving you with hanging with various bits and pieces. But what I want to, what I was surprised to find out, and what I want to share with you is that if Biedermann's persona can then transform in this way in local ways in the relatively recent past in Kerala, it turns out that there's a regionally much wider and temporally deeper transformation of Bhairava in Kerala and a lineage that feeds into his identity and his worship. In exorcistic rites that these same Theyam performers engage in, and a cousin lineage of these performers called the Panar, who are slightly south of the Theyam area, these Panar also propitiate and worship Bhairavan. But they do so with a very different mythological pedigree behind it. Their liturgy to worship Bhairavan in exorcism begins again with an invocation of Bhairavan, which is very much like the Theyam, describing the dress of a Bhairava yogi and so on and so forth. But then it begins, it reverts to another story dealing with a father called Siru Tondar and a son called Chiralan, and begins to tell a very different story about an awesome sort of sacrifice. This myth is set in a mudam, in a yogi's hermitage in northern Kerala, and begins to devolve in ways that I will talk about in a second. It turns out this story has little link to Bhairavan as we know him at all, but it turns out to be related to a much deeper set of stories in South India. And it turns out that this same Siru Tondar is known to the Tamil Shaiva canon, the canon of the Tamil Shaiva saints, which are, of course, independent of the Sanskrit tradition, largely at the early period in the 7th century, where the Siru Tondar is first attested. The son, Chiralan, and I'm going to tell you that myth in a minute, gets mentioned in the 10th or 11th century in Tamil texts, not in Sanskrit texts. I don't know that he ever finds his way into Sanskrit. I may be wrong about that, but I don't think so. And Siru Tondar himself then is made a saint, one of the Nayanmars, one of the 63 Shaiva saints of South India, in the Chola period, starting around the 10th and 11th centuries. And he's celebrated then finally in Chola hagiography, the Periya Puranam, which is a Puranam in ornate Tamil prose, which is the kind of hagiography and compendium of all of these Tamil saints. So it turns out then that this fellow has a very interesting lineage outside of Kerala and outside of this Theyam worship. It's also then adopted the same story into the other regions of South India. It spreads into Karnataka through the Veerashaivas, which I'll be talking about in a little bit. In the 14th century, the Basavana Purana gives all of these stories of these Nayanmars, which are then taken over wholesale into what we think of now as Veerashaiva religion, becoming a part of their hagiography and their canons. It's also spread, Jean Roker's work on Palnada epics in Andhra Pradesh, it's spread into that region as well. So what we have is an entire sort of independent of Sanskrit, we have this major sort of Dravidian spread of these saints throughout South India, probably most commonsensically associated with Chola Imperium, with the hegemony of the Cholas across South India. At any rate, the story then from the Periya Puranam is that there was a great general named Paranjothi from the village of Chengattangudi, who in the Pallava times, let's say 7th century, ended up saving the Tamil kingdom against the Chalukyas, who were their enemies, by defeating them at their capital of Vatapi in Karnataka. The Tamil king then realized, it was revealed to him that this general, who was this great warrior and defeated the enemies, was in fact a great devotee of Shiva. And so rather than incur the possible sin of having a devotee of Shiva die on the field of battle in his service, he decided to retire him to his native town of Chengattangudi, and indeed sent him back there, where despite his glorious profile as this great general and this very wealthy landlord and military leader and so on, he was so humble that he was known as Siru Tondar, which means the little or the humble devotee. He worships Vatapi Ganapati, the Ganapati, the deity of his village that that gave him this this ability and so on, was then worshipped and set up there at Chengatanguri. But what happened is that Shiva did not like this situation. This fellow was too glorious as a general and too humble as a devotee, so he decided that he would put this fellow to the test. And so Shiva shows up as a Bhairava yogi at this fellow's door and demands that he be fed and that he be given whatever he wants. And Shirotondra says, of course, I am your servant. I am the slave of any servant of Shiva's. What is it that you want? And it turns out that he wants a very special pashu, a very special kind of sacrificial victim. And he begins to describe it, and Sirotonda realizes it's a human being that he needs. And not just a human being, but it has to be a 12-year-old child. It has to be the only son of certain kinds of parents, and so on and so forth. And Sirotonda is bound and pledged to do this as a devotee. And he and his wife get together and realize that the only child that will fill this bill and that can be possibly offered up to this Vaidava yogi as a sacrifice is their only child, who is Chiralin. Accordingly, there's, of course, a lot of lamenting and tugging at the heartstrings and so on, but they end up indeed sacrificing the son, cutting him up and making very tasty curries for the Vaidava yogi, who then sits down sits on the, before the banana leaves quite happily, and says, "But of course I can't eat alone. You have to eat with me." Oh. And so the parents are a little upset at that, of course, and the father begins to sit down, and then the Vaidava yogi says, "But I can't. It's not good for me to eat without the little man of the house. Why don't you call your son?" And against all reason and sense, the mother says, cries out, "Chiralin, Chiralin!" And lo and behold, the little lad comes running in from the other room, restored to life. And Shiva, you know, the Vaidava yogi guise is dropped. Shiva reveals himself, and he takes them all off to heaven. So there's a happy ending to this story. Just to give you this roughly just the locale of these, Kanchi, which was the Pallava capital, where he would have been dispatched from, Chengatanguri is down in the Tanjavur Delta, which is his home place where all of these events happen, and Vatapi, the Chalukya capital, is up where you see it there. And that's not good. Okay, well, I'll probably have to catch up with my slide here. The Kerala version of this, I'll now have, with all of that as background, I'm going to revert to the Kerala version. The Kerala version has the same names and the same general plot frame, except that these protagonist of the plot is not a great general, but he's a member of the Choi caste, and I'll come back to that in a little bit. And the son is gotten as a boon from Shiva. The family is childless, and they keep a boon to Shiva that they will get a child. And it turns out that what happens is that the child is offered, but only under the condition that it can either be a dullard and live a long and happy life, or it can be a wonderful and brilliant young lad, but it has to die at the age of 12. And in keeping with the kind of Theyam ethos, there's often this notion of heroic sacrifice and so on involved in this. The parents say they would rather have a noble but short-lived child than a long-lived dullard. So, lo and behold, they get this child, this wonderful Siralin, as the gift of the deity. The story then basically devolves in the same way. The yogis, this time a whole group of yogis, show up demanding to be fed, as in the earlier version. And the unhappy couple are again forced to cut the throat of their only child and dress his various body parts in gory details in the folk version into various kinds of curries. His fingernails are fried up, his chips, and so on and so forth. And then we get to the denouement at the proper moment when the parents are told to call for the child to come. And sorry, I've lost my. Sequence in which I was supposed to reveal these. But in this case, when they call Chiralin, Chiralin, Instead of the child being restored to life, his curried flesh begins to jump on the plates, dancing. And the yogis who've already eaten part of him begin quaking spasmodically in possession. And they realize they're in trouble, that they're all in trouble. This hasn't worked out. So what they do is they go out and set up a bunch of homams, very much like the Brahmins in the Kuti Chatan story, which this has also been paired with in certain respects, and begin to try to exorcize the ghost or the demon of this Kuti Chatan, this Siralan. And after many failed attempts, finally they succeed by installing him as their lineage god at a place called Ponnambalam. And they put him at the right side of the Swami who reigns in the place called Ponnambalam. And they worship him as their Kula Devata, as their lineage deity, their clan deity. So this then becomes a very different kind of trajectory for the story of Bhairavan. And this deity is indeed then said to be Bhairavan. Now, the difference in these two versions of this story raised very interesting problems for me, because what I realized is that the pasted on happy ending where the kid comes back and they all go off to heaven is characterized of these 63 Nayanmar saints, 23 or 24 of them, all share these really horrific kinds of histories in which parents mutilate children or husbands, wives, or people beat their heads on rocks to make paste to worship the god with, or various instances of bloody murder take place in various ways. And in the Shaiva hagiographies, there's always then a happy ending and they go off to Shiva's heaven. I doubted these. I mean, it's particularly in light of this. And it seemed to me a bit contrived. And coming out of the Theyam religion, the Theyam cult as I do, I would tend to suspect that there is a much more ambivalent, dangerous kind of nature of these deities, and that there was a kind of euphemizing and dressing up of these liturgies to make them more acceptable as a kind of official state religion that was going to be spread through institutional temples and so on, based on these kinds of folk sources, which many of them seem to come out of, with warriors and warrior devotees and so on and so forth. So what this led me to do was then actually to look in some detail, rather than to take the Periparanam as the official version, was to go back and see what earlier references there were in the earlier strata of Tamil literature. And indeed, what I found is that there is very little, there's no evidence of this earlier kind of configuration of a happy ending. When you go back in time and you find these very brief references, you simply find either Bhairavan who ate the child, or the father who cut the kid, you know, chopped his son, or something like this, or these very sort of brief characterizations that then get elaborated into this Chola kind of hagiography. These are just the sites of the Nayanmars. There's actually 63 of them. Some of them are too big to, they're too tightly clustered to show with more than one dot. But they're spread across, as you can see, the Tanjore Delta up into the old Pallava country. Madurai there is centered, and there's one over in Kerala. What this led me to do was then to go back to Chengatanguri itself and to figure, okay, if I'm looking at a folk cult, if I'm looking at a regional cult, let me go back to the region. And rather than looking from the Chola court and the hagiographies, to see what kind of evidence there was from Chengatanguri itself. And what I found is very interesting. I found that the earlier textual evidence was only of a sacrifice having been done. Actually, the earliest textual evidence, there was no evidence at all of a discrete child named Chiralan. There was the identification of Siru Tondar as a kind of village headman with a village god, Ganapadishwaram, which is his Ganapati of Vatapi, this god that his victory was attributed to, his lineage, tutelary god, and so on. Chiralan itself, I think, was probably an epithet of Siru Tondar initially, because it's used simply, Chiralan simply means one who is eminent. And I think through time what happened is this became differentiated as the myth began to differentiate into this father-son pairing with this sacrifice and so on. Part of the reason that I came to this conclusion is simply from many kinds of parallels that I found. in which what happens is that someone dies a glorious death, particularly in these various hero cults, and their death is attributed to the god in some sense. Their death is seen as a sacrifice to the god, but then it feeds back to the glory of the deity itself. So the notion then that there were young cadets in this lineage that were going off and dying in battle doubtless, I think, fed the whole local cult of this very prominent sort of big man who had made his name through this loot that he brought back from Vatapi and so on. It's also, I think, helped in certain respects by the fact that Pillayar itself, the Tamil word for Ganapati or for Ganesh is simply Pillayar, which means son or child or offspring. And so Chirala Pillayar doesn't transparently look like it means, you know, anything other than the eminent son, the eminent Pillayar, which could be Ganapadishwaram, and then becomes sort of this esteemed son of Chiralan. Now, what I've done is I've looked through I ordered the various epigraphs and looked at what was being celebrated when, where the deity seemed to be, what the various murtis were that seemed to be established. And it's a bit complex, but I think there's enough there to doubt that it wasn't this sort of profile that we get at the end of the day with the Cholas. Starting then with Rajaraja Chola around 1000, we get successive patronage of this cult as we begin to know it, and then this cult seems to spread out and to link up with these other Nayanmar cults in the Tamil country and become sort of official courtly culture. The second set of inscriptions become really interesting. Of course, what happens is around the 12th century, we suddenly get a new god appear on the scene who is called Uttarapati. And this Uttarapati, which literally means the northerner, or he who travels from the north, comes to supplant and in many ways offset and vie for these other forms of Chiralan, Sirutondar, and this family unit. If we want to know what the identity of this Uttarapati is, it's fascinating, because the Periya Puranam itself names the Bhairava Yogi as Uttarapati. At one point in the Periya Puranam, Siruv Tondar says, "Who are you?" And he says, "Uttarapati Urlom, I am Uttarapati." So we get within the literature then the self-identification of this new god coming on the scene as this wandering Bhairava Yogi who comes into this pre-existing cult and is then incorporated into it. The inscriptions after this then are all basically in the name of Uttarapati, namely of this Bhairavan as this cannibal yogi. So we've got the historical moment then when this cult goes through this kind of transformation. There's a new pantheon then that emerges of Sirutondar, his wife and the child, and Bhairava, who is after all now God in this new cult. And this is spread both into the ancient Chola temple at Chidambaram and also to the new Chola temple at Tanjavur, which was where they built their new capital in the river delta there. So what we get then is this interesting parallel to the same kind of Bhairava transformation that seems to have gone on in Kerala. This is the Bhairava Murti at Chengattangudi itself. Just to give you the relation again between the new capital at Tanjavur and the old temple at Chidambaram, where both of which then this new worship of this deity from Chengattangudi comes up. This is the huge temple complex at Chidambaram. And this is I'll give this away here, but this is called Ponnambalam. This is the golden temple, the golden roof of the temple at Chidambaram itself. One is called the Chidambaram, the Chittambalam. The other is called the Kanaga, the golden umbalam. And these are both then parts of that, the central parts of that temple complex. Just to show that this is part of the same cult, again, if you go back to the image I showed you from Chengattangudi, it turns out that we have liturgical hymns from Chidambaram that tell how an image of Vaidava that's in the shrine at Chidambaram is to be worshipped, and this is taken directly from the hymn in the order it's supposed to come out. As you praise the deity and praise his various parts, he's supposed to have in his left hand a Damaru drum, which is clearly here, a Trishul or a trident. In his right hand, he's supposed to have the noose. In his other right hand, he's supposed to have the skull bowl, and he's supposed to have as his companion the dog then leaping at his feet. So it's clear that the iconography that the people had in mind at Chidambaram was the same as the iconography that was back in the Vaidava image that had been then instituted at Tengatanguri. I want to come back then to the key kind of identifications that this then allows me to make. The Vaidavization of the Chiralan cult in Kerala must have been preceded or modeled on the same activity that was going on in the Tamil country. That is, it had probably either it borrowed in the earlier strata of the Chiralan cult, and then when it was Vaidavanized, when this Vaidava yogi appeared, it accepted that layering as well, which means that they were in very close contact, or it was as a result of Chola Imperium spreading this canonical version itself, which is also then is shared with the Andhra and the Karnataka country and so on. It's quite clear in the Kerala liturgy itself that they're aware of this transition, because when Chiralan breaks out and speaks through the Vaidava yogis that he's possessed of, as the curry meal that's in their tummies, he says that I for so long was Chiralan am now the yogi Vaidavan. So in the possessed voice of the yogis themselves, he's announcing who he is. The Ponnambalam of the Kerala yogis, which are called Choi, is actually the Karnaga Sabha of Chidambaram. The name is the same, the place is the same. There is a Bhairava then installed, which is not very widely known. The Nadaraja, right, the dancing Raja at Chidambaram, is the famous Murti of the god, but there's a small Bhairava beside him to his right, and this is actually called Svarna Kalabhairavan, the golden Kalabhairavan. And what this recalls is, of course, going back to the initial myth. If you remember when Vaidava came down to earth at Kadram and was dealing with the Kadram Raja, he said that he had come from the Kanaga Raja, the golden Raja, and he was dissatisfied there. Clearly then this Kanaga Raja is this golden Vaidavan back at Chidambaram. So it's a recollection then of this myth. He also came from Kangala Mountain, and Kangala Murti is one of the Murtis of Vaidavan that's installed at Chidambaram as well. So what we have then is a concerted kind of regional development of this cult of Vaidava coming in from the north and colonizing in some sense these earlier Tamil layers of religion, Shaiva religion, and also penetrating into the folk religion of Deyam in these very interesting ways. As for the place where Vaidava descends initially, Kadram, it turns out after considerable sleuthing and some good luck, I was able to figure out and to find that Kadram was a monastery called Kadri in Mangalore. And if you remember from the map I showed you, Mangalore is southernmost end of Karnataka in the Tulu country, just north of Kerala, where this Deyam cult is practiced. And that this place that he descends is called Kadram and is the local realization of Kadri, this monastery. Its history, we know it was a Nath Siddha monastery from the 12th century. The Nath Siddhas were a contemporary sect of yogis, probably the most dimly understood of these Shaivite groups of Tantrikas who were coming into the south. It's not even certain how old the Nath Siddha cult is, because it's been overlain by many kind of wandering mendicant groups. But they were contemporaries of the Kalamukha monastics that I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, these institutionalized Vaidava yogis who colonized these huge temple tracts in Karnataka from the 11th to the 13th centuries. And what we know of the history of this region is that the Veerashaivas, which was the latest and sort of last of these monastically based developments in Karnataka, became very militant and anti-Orthodox in certain respects, Orthodox in others, and supplanted many of the earlier groups. Again, David Lawrenson, who's worked on all this material in Karnataka, has made it very clear that by the 14th century, the Veerashaivas had pretty much supplanted the Kalamukha groups that were previously, that is, the same sites that used to be Kalamukha sites, are now Veerashaiva. And of course, this is the Lingayat religion of Karnataka, this very dominant strain of very radical sort of Shaivism. So there was then this massive replacement around the 14th century and on. And it turns out then in relationship with particular lineages. And fortunately for me, I was able to trace this at Kadri itself, because while we only know circumstantially what happened, we can only sort of presume circumstantially what happened for the replacement of Kalamukhas by these Veerashaivas. In the case of this particular Nath Siddhanath monastery, we have the interesting report of an Italian traveler, Pietro della Valle, who visited the site of Mangalore and visited the site of Kadri in 1623, where he met a fellow that he called the King of the Yogi. That's the spelling that he gives. Reading this this account is very challenging, even in the English, because of these interesting formations. But what happened, what had just happened when Pietro della Valle visited, is that the mutt had been sacked by a Veerashaiva general warlord who later became a king called Venkatapada Nayaka. And he had carried off the pontiff's elephants, gold, jewelry, and so on and so forth. So he met a very dejected king of the yogis there who no longer seemed to be much of a king. And he was fearing, he expressed to Pietro that he was afraid these guys were going to come back and really exact heavy tribute and really break up the monastery. That indeed seems to be more or less what happened. After this, there was a major Veerashaiva push all the way into northern Kerala, all the way into the Deyam country, down where I worked in Nileshwaram, and so on. So it seems that then what we have is the source of these Bhairava yogis, the centrality of this place in their in the mythology of what then becomes the Bhairavan Deyam in Kerala. This is Kadri, an old view, which I found from a historical archive of the early 1900s. This is the temple. There's a temple at the base of the place. This is the temple today. It's a very prosperous temple. What happens is that there's actually a mutt associated with it, and it turns out, I assumed from the records that it was extinct, but it's still there's still a relic population of Nath Siddhas living there. I don't think that they're the same people. I think another group has come and colonized it after this initial breakup. This is an aerial view of the complex. The temple is here. There's a really remarkable set of architectural features, which are huge stone baths that are carved in the rock face up above the temple for bathing. And then there's an entry, there's a gatehouse with a long walkway that leads through this gatehouse. This is, again, an aerial view up a pathway through an entry gate, and then what I've labeled there is the remnants of the yogi mudam up to the far right of the screen. So there's still a handful of monolingual Hindi-speaking yogis living there that seem to have nothing to do with the surrounding culture, that claims that they're incorporated sometimes in some of the temple rites, but it basically the local Tuluva population seems to have totally taken over the temple, and there's clearly not this this great monastic organization there anymore. This is just to give you a sense that the mudam is up on this hill in a slightly askew view. These are not yogis. I was able to buy some literature there when I was just there the last time and to get their liturgical texts, because I want to try to figure out if they're really affiliated with these earlier Nath yogis and so on. And this is the way they look. This is not at Kadri. This is they go all the way up through Karnataka into Maharashtra, and they seem to be centered in Rajasthan and have mudams in Gujarat as well. So there's this really strangely itinerant group of people. Every 12 years, a new fellow gets installed as king of the yogis at Kadri. So it's an ongoing kind of thing. But when I first met the pontiff before, he was sitting watching wrestling on his television set, and just seemed bored out of his mind. So he was there with one attendant. So it's not a great operation, but it's still either hanging on or revived in this way. To wrap up then on the Kerala side, and this really becomes just interesting historically and ethno-historically, ethnologically, and so on. The final myth of the Bhairava yogi deyam, if you know the mainstream version of this, Bhairava, with the head of Brahma stuck to his hand, this skull, wanders around for 12 years and finally goes to the Ganga and gets it Kapala Moksha. He goes to this ghat and bathes, and he's released of the curse of this this skull he's been carrying around. In the Kerala version, what happens is that after 12 years of penance, this Bhairava finally gets very angry and through the force of his tapas and penance whacks his thigh, and a chunk of his thigh flies off and creates a little yogi. And he gives the yogi the skull vessel, and he says, go and make your living using this. And the skull vessel is called a kelipatram, literally a vessel of fame. Go and make your living doing this. Another set of folk songs in northern Malabar tell about, indeed, a caste called the Choi. And Choi is clearly just the local garbling variant of yogi, and tells about a caste of these yogis who came into northern Kerala, and these songs, these folk songs, recount their assimilation into agrarian society. So it tells, in some sense, how they took to farming, how they settled into the community, and so on. So I have this beautiful sort of convergence of folk literature, of ethnohistory, of historical sources, suggesting something about these connections. The deyams themselves, the deyams of Bhairavan, tell that he maintained this connection to someone who's called a Kadaroor Swami, which is clearly this this Kadri guru, this pontiff. Then what makes it also then finally, I think, makes sense of the two earlier episodes of the deyam, the first being the destruction of their line in Kadram. The first myth, as you remember, Bhairavan actually destroys them. That is, he kills the issue of the yogi pontiff by throwing him in the fire. The second episode, the resettlement into Kerala, is rather happier in the sense that he's then assimilated. Bhairavan is assimilated into the local cult and the local culture, and is indeed worshipped by the Nambudris. Often in this culture, when things go wrong, it's interpreted as the deity having gotten angry with you having created some kind of ritual dereliction that then brings the wrath of the deity on you, and so on. So it's how I then interpret these two opening episodes of the myth, the souring of relations at Kadram, and then the happier accommodation of the wandering bite of a yogi when he comes to Kerala. Also then, these yogis undergo a kind of elevation in status. Clearly they had learning, they were appreciated as people coming out of monastic order, and they are often known as gurukul, an honorific of the word guru, and they themselves then have various deyams, that is, their various gurus who become apotheosized, often in violent tantric encounters, in one instance even with the king of northern Kerala, and they themselves then become apotheosized in various forms as deyams and are incorporated into this whole cult. So that is the extent of the story. I think I've pretty much closed up all of these ends. And where I'm going with this is in two ways. First of all, on the local side, in this recent field season, I found yogis living in northern Kerala, I found their institution. There were no yogis at home when I was there, unfortunately, and I only had a quick visit. So this is Sri Puliyakart Yogi Madam, and this is in central northern Kerala. And it turns out there's four of these around. What's very interesting is that despite being called a Yogi Madam, it's not a hermitage. Yogis don't live there. It's simply their house now, their taravad, their manor. And what they do is they worship here on a yearly basis, exactly the way other lower caste groups do deums. And in fact, you can see there's a tiny little image on the roof here. The wing over here had this image on the roof of it, which is actually the Bhairavan Deum. You may recognize him from the photos I showed you earlier. So what's happened is they've installed the deum to themselves in their own shrine. So they're now worshiping the local form of themselves. The caste that performs their deum recognizes that they got their deum from the yogis themselves. And what I should have told you, I forgot to tell you, is when they do this Kelipatram, this notion where Shiva tells the Bhairava yogi, go and perform this, these yogis themselves actually have a little ritual they do once a year in which they walk around with an artificial skull cup and stand around temples begging alms. They have to do that one day out of the year, and then they go home again. But it's based on that kind of practice that these deum groups then took them up as material for this deum cult, and have elaborated them into this form, which now the yogis themselves are worshiping in conclave with other deum deities, which are flanking here. So there's a cluster of deum deities that these fellows go on and perform, which is quite interesting. That's in some sense on the ethnographic end. On the historical end, what all of this points to, and many of you will, of course, know this, of course, also being based here at Oxford, where Saunderson has been producing amazing material for many years. What we're beginning to really learn is that there's a pan-Indic tantrism associated in the softer side with Shaiva Siddhanta, which is the sort of mainstream form of Tamil temple culture, ritual, and its shastras that support it. That's on the Shaiva side. On the Vaishnava side, you have the Pancharatra traditions, the Shri, which becomes the Shri Vaishnava tradition, also of the temple worship in the Vaishnava mode. And that all of these were quite clearly now transplanted to the south. We used to think of these as sort of indigenous, especially if you were schooled in the Tamil school of things. You believed that these were indigenous kinds of productions that grew up from the soil of Tamil religiosity and so on. Now we realize that this situation was far more complex than this. What we're also realizing, again, mostly from the work of Saunderson and many of his students, is the lead role that Kashmir had in this consolidation and dissemination of these amazing cults of largely Shaiva and Vaishnava materials influenced in this whole kind of tantric matrix. And it's not accidental, I think, that this coincided with the Chola Imperium in the south. That is, we know that Cholas were bringing in these people from the north and settling them. And indeed, if you remember the name of Bhairava from the medieval Tamil literature, Uttarapadi, that he's the northerner who comes in. We get then the folk registry of this whole business going on. What we also know now that's quite surprising, again, just because of incredibly exacting textual research into Sanskrit materials, is that centers like Chidambaram, Kanchi, and Madurai were actually centers of Kaula, of this particularly sort of Kashmiri Shaiva forms of worship, that they had lineages. In addition to the mainstream Shaiva Siddhanta temple religion, that there were madams and lineages established there. The Nath Siddhas, which we talked about at Kadri, are clearly linked in many of their scriptures back to Nepali cults of the Kubjaga school and so on. In the Tamil side of things, we have Tirumular. Within the Shaiva Siddhanta corpus, we have one work called the Tirumantram, literally the sacred mantram, which is this bizarre assemblage of what you can recognize as largely sort of, I would say, North Indian and probably Kashmiri Shaiva material that was assimilated into this Tamil matrix and made part of canonical South Indian literature. Finally, the Kalamukkas themselves claim in their inscriptions and so on that they are of Kashmiri lineage. So it's an amazing set of just convergences, not just across South India in this way, but if you just zoom out, and I just have fun with Google Earth in this way, but just as a final thing, to see, you know, the amazing length and scope of this dissemination of lineages and of very tough philosophical literatures, of crazy practices, cults of power, and so on. It's quite remarkable. I found some of these texts now, clutches of them in Kerala, and I'm going to try to work on that, including some that actually tell of a fellow who in his lifetime went from Madurai to Kashmir and back. So, you know, it really, for me as a regionally based ethnographer, it's really quite a reach and quite a challenge for me to think of these things in this way. The reason that I stay with the ethnography and the local vernacular and so on is that I think it's important that the one problem with a lot of the textual scholarship that's going on now is it remains at the level of Sanskrit text. It's as though these people were replicating themselves in some kind of, you know, hermetically sealed textual debate with themselves. And it's clearly a part of lineages, of patronages, of history. And it's clearly then not simply a Brahminical phenomenon. And if you look only at the Sanskrit text being argued by Brahmins, even if they're, you know, crazy sort of sadhaka Brahmins arguing their versions of sacred power against others, it seems as though it's cut off very much from the rest of society. And what you really get then when you look at the ethnology and coming out of something like Deum is a sense of how deeply these things penetrated and how everything that we're interested in as social scientists can become articulated in these very fraught and interesting ways. So thank you. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you, Rich. That was really very fascinating.